What does it take to build your own lab or to even only work in a lab? What are the main challenges, needs, but also maybe features for success to establish something like that?
Yeah, Nico, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be here today. So maybe just some words about my background. So you spoke about the lab, you spoke about the lab of the future. For sure, we will address this in detail in this podcast. But my background, and many of you may know that, but some may not, is I'm a physician. I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor for internal medicine. I'm a doctor for hematology. And I see patients and I treat patients now since 39 years. So this is maybe completely for many people different and the opposite from what this lab means that my colleagues and I are also leading. And the question may be coming to the lab and why, what should you do and why we have this lab. So as I said, I'm a hematologist. I see patients, I treat patients, I communicate with patients about the malignant disease, about cure or not cure, how we can achieve this. And this is quite different than 40 years ago today. That's good for everyone, especially for the patients. But I realized from the first beginning that speaking about a diagnosis and speaking about treatment, first of all, relies on the diagnosis, on the quick diagnosis when we speak about leukemias and lymphomas or any other malignant disease. A more comprehensive diagnosis and a correct diagnosis. And where I started to work with this problem, and this is also still true in many, many other scenarios and countries for good reasons, a diagnostic approach today is based on many different techniques: cytomorphology, cytogenetics, molecular genetics. You spoke about molecular genetics right now, immunophenotypic, immune histochemistry, histology. All that, if we speak about malignant diseases. And what more or less the standard is in many scenarios is that you have one problem, but one or two or three or four or five different reports addressing the same question. What is the disease? Where is the specific classification? What are the markers to give specific options for treatment? Precision medicine is the key word. And what are the markers for measurable residual disease, MRD, today? And for sure, there are many, many experts worldwide that deliver one or two or three or even more of these questions in one or two or three reports. But finally, there's only one doctor and one patient. And what I saw, and that was the way I started, is that we should start by combining these different experts in one team, in one place, and in one database. Not only to be quicker, but also to be more comprehensive and especially to learn from the others, because every method has pros and cons, some things that can be done better, but, or only by one method, but not by the others. And it is very helpful to get support. But if there is no directly connection to what the others are doing right now and what their knowledge at the respective time point is while they process or finally write the report for this patient, there is a gap of information. And that, from my perspective, hampers sometimes the best possible diagnosis. And therefore, I started to think about this laboratory that we now do here. I think that is not quite the answer you expected, but at least it explains why we started to do what we do right now.
And what would you say, what did it take you at the beginning? So when you formulated, you worked as a doctor And then you had this urge, I presume, otherwise you wouldn't have done such a huge thing, that there is maybe like a really a niche that doesn't exist at the moment when you started it. How was this transition done, or can you even describe it? I don't know if that's even possible, but when you started the transformation to really realize this, what would you say, what did it take, what was the first, or the what were the first like few very, very important steps, milestones you think back and say, yeah, that was the moment where I really had had a fight or had a challenge and I overcame it, and that was really, really important.
You just said in your last sentence, think back. If you think back, maybe this is one of the things I did. Let's put it in two ways and go from up to down and from down to up again. So it is more or less quite easy to start with something when you say what I am doing. I'm diagnosing leukemias as best as I can, and this is what I'm doing. The more important step on three steps is, how do I do it? This gives us some ideas about a lab infrastructure or any infrastructure. How do I run a hospital? Who do I run a practice? How do I build a house? But the most important thing, and this is thinking backwards, is the most important thing is, why do I do something? And if you start with why do I do something, or why do I miss something, then you go backwards and say, if this is what I feel is missing, this is the reason, this is the cause, I want to do it. Patients care as quick, as good as possible to start treatment and to cure more patients. Then I go back and say, how can I do it and what will I do? And this is where we started. I defined the unmet need. And then I had to look for solutions. And it sounds a little bit like a miracle, but it's just, I don't like that word, but anyhow, some people use it. It's thinking out of the box. So one very important thing is, and maybe it seems quite funny to say that, but just imagine you want to put a very, very great experienced head of, let's say, radiology and a neurosurgeon and a radiotherapist in one room and say, you are all great, but from now on, you have to work together because this patient needs it in this minute. They will say, well, I'm great anyhow. Why should I work with these guys over there? And that means if you think about combining experts for one goal, one patient, five experts, really experts, but one diagnosis, it's quite difficult to find those people because you cannot start from the scratch and say, so everyone is now on the training and finally we all be great. That's not the way it works. And I think this is still difficult. It's fully agreeable that it's difficult for humans to work together in a team, especially when you're alpha people and think you are so wonderful and why should you combine your knowledge with others and share something. But this is what really makes the difference. So the idea was to bring people together to work for one. Why are we doing that? How do we do that? And what are we doing there? And then, and this is what I have to admit, is that the infrastructure in any different country, in Europe or elsewhere in the world, or even I can speak about Germany best, inside the academia, or outside the academia is quite difficult and quite different. And for sure, I fully agree that we need academia as well as we need industry, and we need outpatient setting, we need practitioners just taking care for patients. But the freedom to decide something on a very quick way is higher when you're responsible, not in a huge institution, but with very few people or only one person. You may be wrong, then it fails and you are done forever. But if you are making some right decisions and more right decisions than wrong decisions, you may be quicker. And this sometimes it saves you time and it brings you quicker to forward. And this was one important aspect, my last sentence to that. Leaving the academia and setting up a private laboratory now nearly 18 years ago, owned by now three people, my wife and Wolfgang Kern and myself, makes us much more flexible, but also much more powerful to make decisions, to say, we don't do that or we do it, but if we do, we start today. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most important things, and take it home messages maybe, that outside the academia, you might be quicker. I'm afraid we couldn't do it inside any kind of university setting, what we are doing right now.
Mm. Yeah, that's. I think that sums up a lot of feelings that also a lot of colleagues that I meet, not only in Germany and Italy and Spain, even the US, have the same feeling that there are kind of advantages in academia, in university hospitals. But you're what you perfectly said, and that's my everyday routine when you have a patient and you need to consult for, I don't know, nephrology or gastroenterology. It's always this kind of isolated talk. Yeah, we could do that, but it's just a recommendation. You need to do the decision. And that's sometimes quite frustrating, to be honest. I really, really, really admire the stamina that I presume it really takes to find also the people to make the right decisions. And when you said you had a kind of a, that's what I understood, a kind of a holistic approach from the beginning to try to combine every technique, let's stay in hematology, that is out there. You already mentioned some of them, but do you recognize a certain development? We will definitely come to what I already alluded to molecular diagnostics, etc. But given that your approach was quite holistic and tried to combine everything, was there kind of a shift in the at some point where you try to focus only on one method, or do you still practice this holistic approach?
Well, yes, a good question. So first of all, I said at the beginning, I'm a hematologist. That means I'm no pathologist. And that we never changed. So we have the advantage that in hematology, especially in liquid tumors like leukemias and lymphomas, we today can do a lot of diagnostic approaches, nearly all of them, without tree-fine biopsies, without lymph nodes, without solid tumor biopsies taken by surgeons. And we never started to implement histology here in the Munich Leukemia Laboratory because it wasn't our business. And I decided at the beginning that we will not start implementing that because we had a very strong infrastructure, very positive experience infrastructure in leukemia and lymphoma pathologists in Germany here. I was born in Kiel. There was the Kiel classification. I know Professor Lennart himself. He was the founder. He had so many good professors worked with him and have a lot of infrastructure in Germany still now and the next generation of pathologists that we didn't start that. But we started, and this is what I'm still doing, we started with morphology. And if you would ask me, where is my microscope? It is here. Mm. So this is on the same table. It's everyday work, working at the microscope still, but not at the pathologist, but with smears, peripheral blood and bone marrow smears. And we started first on the beginning to combine the same for the same patients with cytogenetics, because my wife is a cytogeneticist. And then we included immunophenotyping, what was already there, but not in-house, our lab, but somewhere else done for studies in Germany. And then when I started, I can tell you that when I ended my medicine study in 1983, there was no PCR. So Karl Malles invented and had the idea of a PCR in 1984. So I never learned about PCR when I started medicine. So that means when I started to work as a doctor, there was no PCR. There were no genes, at least they were not available in daily routine. And therefore we had the beauty, but also the need to implement everything that is new from the knowledge about genes, about chromosomes, about expression, not only in immunophenotyping, but also in genetics, and also in molecular genetics, especially to try to get them in-house in our routine as quick as possible. Because there were so many papers published in the last 40 years finding out that this chromosomal aberration is common in this disease, or this expression is common in this ALL. And all the markers that are now known for myeloid or lymphatic diseases, as well as for lymphomas, with respect to mutations or expression, that we started to implement them as quick as possible and trying to build this up as quick as possible. And that means when there's a new gene that we think is of importance for the diagnosis of any kind of disease in hematology, we try to have them in our routine, in accredited routine, ISO and CAP accredited, within 4 to 8 weeks after the paper is there. And that makes us always working quickly, but also being state of the art. And one other thing, my thought was, when you spoke about infrastructure, we made the decision when we started here in 2005, so 18 years ago, there is no paper in the lab. There is only digital. There is only PDF. There is only barcode. There is no paper. And that seems to be quite curious for your and strange for your infrastructure. And I know that. But it makes things easier when you can start from the scratch and say, we need solutions where we don't need any paper.
Well, I think that's, I mean, what I like about it is when you said, yeah, this might be curious to me, because my university hospital, I don't want to blame it too much, but everyone talks about let's minimize paperwork, let's be digital, but that's one thing to talk about it and to try it. The other thing is to just do it and implement it. And what you said about solutions, I think is really, really important to, what everyone can learn, I think, from your experience is to just really try to do it, and that this will keep you ahead of most of all institutions, definitely. One other thing that I would like to ask you is, when you already started this, that you wanted to do every year, basically there came up a new study defining a certain mutation for a certain disease, and but when we live now, what would you say, what is the actual status, what is the real status of molecular genetics, the role of it, how can it be implemented even with outside of like these kind of institutions, or should it be centralized even? That's what you do. What would you say, what is the status, where are we with that, and maybe you can have a look into the future a little bit, where are we currently going, where's the train going, what's the end result?
So I'm very happy and also satisfied that especially the molecular genetic instruments, as well as assays, and what is very important, also the readouts, the bioinformatic pipeline, that helps you to see what's coming from the sequencer, but what is really right, what is a variant of unknown significance, what is a benign SNP, and what is a damaging variant, we called it mutation. What is that? And that has to be learned over the last 30 years. But now, and this is why I'm happy, we have instruments that are very, very safe and reliable when they work. It was different when we started with next generation sequencing 14 years ago from now. That was different when we started with the NovaSeq, these big sequencers. We had the first machine in Europe. But this was even better than 10 years before. And this is still true right now. So there's a very, very strong, reliable, and good working infrastructure with the instruments. The assays are, many of them are CE labeled or FDA approved. So they are quite safe. And you are not you don't rely on experienced people like me who know how to read a bone marrow. This is phenotype. This is many, many years of experience, learning, seeing so many things. So it's quite easier to reproduce, from my perspective, easier. It's not easy, but it's easier to reproduce molecular methods by the machine, by the assays, maybe even FDA or CE label. Have a pipeline that helps you to read the results, and then you have to write the reports. And therefore, I'm quite positive that for many, many hospitals, university hospitals especially, and also other laboratories, it does not need to be centralized. Because you can run it at your place and you save time if you have enough cases and the infrastructure at your place with technicians, with biologists or hematologists or pathologists, maybe even with bioinformatic experience. There is just one caveat still right now. If you only have one case a day or one case a week, it is not very useful to do this, because who shall pay all this personnel for one case a week? Who shall buy the machine, the maintenance for the machine? You need maintenance contracts to run these machines to get service when something is broken. You don't want to buy consumables that have experienced times where they cannot be used, expiration days, but you don't use them because you don't have the samples. And therefore, you always have to make your decision. What can you do in-house and what do you have to send away? The same is true even in big university hospitals. There are some things you don't do in-house, you have to send away, and others you can do in-house. If you have a PET scan, you do the PET scan in-house. If you don't have it, you have to send those patients away that need a PET scan. And I think this is, first of all, you need something to teach your people. That's true. Second, you have to be careful with the money you spend for something. And third, you need quality. And quality is very important. And therefore, there are so many local options to organize even molecular genetics locally, but there are still some questions where you will have to think about if you want to have it, to send it away. And just one thing I want to add, because I just learned this today. So we are discussing a lot with the German insurance companies, healthcare bodies, and everyone, where will whole genome sequencing be in the future? Will it be feasible? Will it be payable? Will it be useful? Who will do it? And when will we implement that? For what reason? So again, why do we want it? Why? Because we know it works. We can do it. Yes, we can even tell you how we do it. We can even tell you how we accredited it. But why do we think we need it? And I was just aware today that the NCCN guidelines for AML, for the first time, last update, allowed whole genome sequencing in routine diagnostics of AML. In the same chapter where cytogenetics and panel sequencing is written. I don't say that's the solution for everyone in the world today, but it will be there someday. And then you again have to think, can I do it in every hospital? Should I try to do that or send do I send it away? There is no final answer from me right now. I just say we have to be flexible, and there are some good reasons to discuss and to decide for this and this and this solution. There is no truth today that is still true in 2 years from now.
Yes, because one other thing that I think everyone steps upon is when reading papers, for instance, let's say AML papers, everyone, not everyone, obviously not to generalize, but there's a lot of heterogeneity in the panel that is used. And the question is probably, should we do this kind of, like what you said, like broad panel sequencing, even whole genome sequencing, and thereby also increase the noise we get? Or will it be at some point feasible to switch to real precision medicine to just look for something particular? But then the problem is that's only one information you have when you already know you can only look for it. So this is like a quite a redundant, because how should you know you only need to look for one particular information, let's say mutation or one cytogenetic aberration or so. What would you say, will we still keep this like at the beginning to have like a little bit of a broader approach, and then maybe if we have that, we can continue to make it more precise along the disease course, over the treatment, etc.?
Yeah, very good question. I start with one example before I go to the molecular genetics. So if you apply a fish probe for BCR-ABL and you pipette it on the cells and they are negative, then you just know one thing. This patient does not have translocation 922. If you take the viable cells and you take the chromosomes and you look for a karyotype, you will also see that there is no translocation 922, but you may see it's a translocation 1517. So if you just spot on one thing, this is what you just said, you will only say, yes, this is there or this is not there. If you have a clear question from immunophenotyping, it's a mantle cell lymphoma, and you say, we do 1114 translocation fish probe on there and it's positive, then we are done. That's true, but it may be also more than one mutation, one translocation in the same patient. And then it's 1, 2, 3 hit, and this is different. Coming to the molecular approach, right now, I fully agree that panel sequencing, defining 50, 100, maybe 200 genes, I'm not a friend of 500 or 1,000 genes, because I think there is not enough decisions from all these genes after that. But I can tell you that we run in our myeloid panel 73 genes, and the lymphatic panel the same, but there are overlapping genes. So if we add both panels to one panel, and we can do this, it is around 120 genes. And this is, from our perspective, those genes that we are interested in with respect to classify, diagnose, prognose, and open any, as far as we know, option for precision medicine right now in leukemias and lymphomas and multiple myeloma, as well as we do here. On the other hand, the exome, the transcriptome, and the genome, as you said, has a lot of noise, but more or less all information. Not with a coverage of 1,000 something, but only coverage of 30, 60, we do 100 coverage X for a genome. So quite highly covered, even the genome, but not 1,000 or even more that we do with the panels. But there you have more information. For example, is there any drug maybe not allowed for this patient in the future? Have we any more information that we never thought about we would like to have? Or could we even explain some of the diseases that we cannot solve by our gold standard methods that are already far advanced? And I can tell you that we do it right now in a prospective study. And we already enrolled 60 patients where we have wonderful gold standard results, and there is no final solution what this patient has. And in one third of these patients, we had an ASH abstract last year, in one third of these patients, we found the solutions by the genome and the transcriptome combination. So that's not only 5% more, it's not 10%, it's not 100%, but it's one third. And those are also patients where we are struggling right now, even if we have a far advanced technology to diagnose these patients. So right now, I think panels is great. Everyone should do this, and this is also standard and guidelines. For ALLs, there is still now already in ICC and also especially in WHO classification, a transcriptome suggested for specific ALL subtypes, because you cannot pick them up without a transcriptome. But the genome, I said you, for AML, it's now in the guideline, but I think for right now, the infrastructure isn't there and the knowledge is too much and there is not enough consequences after that. But that may be different in 3 to 5 years, and I think it will be. And there, if you would ask me this again, I think the answer will be different. Today, no routine with genomes.
And all the analysis, when you even say like transcriptomics, well, not only one person can look at transcriptomics and say that's the diagnosis. I know what's in there. You need definitely technology. You already talked about this. And that also, again, means you need infrastructure, you need resources. How did you implement this into your lab? Was it there from the beginning? Or did you like learn this also along the way? What is needed? Because how can you know if techniques become more complex, you only know then, okay, I need something more to analyze it. And what would you say, what is the reality right now? Because everyone talks about this bullet point AI, machine learning, some call them AI machine learning and vice versa. What is the status in your opinion in hematology and diagnostics at the moment for this? What's the reality?
The reality is that all these techniques are not in routine, more or less. There are other fields, radiology, for example, dermatology, that are far advanced, as far as I know, especially in America. First of all, if you speak about data, it starts with the storage and the data and the calculation of the data. We had to make this decision when we started our 5,000 genome project in 2018. And we had to balance. We think that the data is in-house handleable, safe, and also can be maintained? Or are we looking for a cloud solution? And this cloud, for sure, as well as every other local organization, has to adhere to the data security laws in Europe as well as in Germany. And we pressed Illumina, who was and still is the only one who can run genomes in a high scale, to find a solution. And the solution we now have, and this is completely accredited and also adhering to every data security law in Germany as in well as in Europe, is a cloud infrastructure that we have with AWS, but it can also be Azure cloud from Microsoft or any other cloud with a big scale. And why did we do that? First of all, the infrastructure in-house is quite expensive and we have to maintain it. And think about your iPhone or think about your computer. You cannot work with a computer that is 10 years there anymore because it doesn't work what you want to do. And so we decided to, we calculated that in the just for the hardware infrastructure without any personnel, without any maintenance, without any ability to calculate the data, we had to spend 500,000 euro at the start and then all the rest. Now, if we go to the cloud, we have to pay per use. Mm. How many data you have there? How do you want to use them? It's like on your iPhone. It's like many things we do today. Netflix. I don't have Netflix, but you know what that means. You don't have to have all these films in-house. You just go there and then you have it. The same as for music, Apple Music, anything like that. So we went to the cloud. It's in Frankfurt, in Germany. We have two different lines directly to the cloud. So also someone could destroy just by accident one of our data lines to the cloud in Frankfurt. And the data set right now for our 5,500 genomes and transcriptomes for all these patients is 3 petabyte. So it's quite difficult to imagine what 3 petabyte is. I can tell you that it would be a Netflix video, and you have to sit in front of your TV day and night for 100 years. So this is 3 petabyte. It's only 5,500 genomes. But this is for the storage, but you also can calculate these 5,500 genomes in a cloud like that. And therefore, I know all these discussions about data security and so on and so on, but I don't see any other solution for huge data and for pipelines that work with this data and help us to understand the data. And the same for sure, if we speak about big data, is true for AI. So you cannot build any AI workflow algorithm without data, with very good data, with this data that really are strong and speak to each other. And as you may know, we have AI as pilots in all our parts in the laboratory. And for example, in cytogenetics with chromosomes and karyotyping in more than 2 years now in routine. And we couldn't do this without any AI anymore. For getting to our turnaround times and to serve this patient's needs, coming back to the why are we doing that without AI today, and that will be even more in the next future. And I just spoke to my bioinformatic people and people that program all our software tools and our lab infrastructure for our LIMS system in the lab. And some of them now experienced AI to support their programmings. You cannot take it one by one and then it's done. But you give a question, you get back an AI-driven programming lines, and then you look, this is right or not. And one of my bioinformatic guys, who's also very experienced in cloud computing as well as in AI, he says, for many of our needs, I need to program right now. I say 50% of the time adding AI for programming. ChatGPT is just now, everyone speaks about that. It's a hype. But this is what will be in the future. And if we control it by human, and this is what we do, sure, we work with patients' data, we work with diagnosis, with leukemias. If we control this AI-supported algorithms and tools by humans before we write a report, my experience here in the pilots, as well as in our routine accredited settings, is we should use this. And I always quote Eric Topol, who is a very famous American cardiologist and human geneticist. And he says, I do not think that AI will completely make physicians not useful anymore. But those physicians who will not use AI, they will not be physicians anymore in the next years. And therefore, we have to be open. I don't say that's the solution. I don't say that's all right. This is everything now possible, and we are now safe for everything. But we have to be open and test it. If we don't test it, we will not learn how we can use it and where the limits are.
Yeah, and specifically, you need to have this, what you said from the beginning, this like open collaboration with people who really understand this stuff. And you, because not every physician can work their way into programming, right? You don't have the time. That's the, you're better at something else. And for that, I think that's a really, really beautiful approach to be open from every side. Also, as a programmer, you need to work with your ego that something like a machine programs 50% of your work. But I mean, that's beautiful to have this kind of work relationship across disciplines where everyone says, well, let's use it for our advantage so that we can achieve our goal. What you said, right? The question is why. That I really love that approach. But when we come to the next thing, maybe that's why. Maybe with AI we wouldn't have this discussion. But still, when we talk about classifications, like we had now with in hematology, there are still physicians. I don't know. Maybe sitting at a table or sitting in front of their notebook at a Zoom meeting and try to define what is some kind of AML, what is another kind of AML. And but I think we don't need to go into this kind of controversy. But maybe to if you I think you were part of at least one, maybe you can describe which part, which one. And yes. Maybe to describe to trainees, how does that work? How do you approach this to classify something, let's say, like AML?
You mean in our daily routine now, how the WHO or ICC classification started to be as it is right now?
Maybe both.
Okay. So my wife and myself here in the lab, we were for the first time invited to contribute to some of the WHO chapters, depending on our expertise. And the same is true for the ICC people, and I know nearly all of them that are engaged there, because every one of us has specific expertises. And for, then we have to accept that everything that goes in any classification has to be science, has to be peer-reviewed papers. There is no gut feeling. Sorry, that is out. So there is papers. Okay, so one should think that if there are 10 papers and two people read these 10 papers, they come to the same conclusion that this is the truth and this is more or less the truth and this is for sure not the truth. But you know, that's not true. Some people read the papers like that way, the others like that way. Some don't have the experience and just can see what is there. Others have the experience and say, well, this is quite stupid. What they write there, I'm sorry, it's published, but I don't believe in that because my data is like that. But this is true for ICC as well as for WHO. So there are experts in the field and the database should be the same. But there is the overlap, maybe is 85 or 90%. But why is that? Where are the 10 to 15% differences? Because some people say, I think this is more important and I believe this is still not true and we have to wait for more data. And the others say, I think this is more important. I think the data is enough and we can make a decision. It's yes or no. And this is okay. It's the discussion. And I think we will be in some years from now behind this discussion we now have, because it's good we have the discussions. Because if we have the same truth, it's great. Everyone says, well, there is no discrepancy in both classifications. So this is the truth. This truth can be different in 5 years from now for both classifications, because there's a new truth, new knowledge, new data, new information, new genes, whatever that means, new drugs. But for those cases, for those definitions where we are not believing the same thing, I like this discussion. It's really necessary. People will and already sit at the same table and discuss, why do you think that? Why do I think that? And I'm sure there will be solutions. And what the beauty from my perspective is that the WHO classification so far has two papers as well as the ICC has, or let's have three papers or even four papers. But as you know, papers are papers and they will never change. They are there. And if they are 1 year old, they are now already nearly 1 year old. If they are 2 years old, 3 years old, it's a problem. But the WHO, not only for the Blue Book for Hematology, but also for many, many other WHO classifications, brain tumors and all that, they have online versions. Like Wikipedia is an online dictionary. Like UpToDate is an online dictionary, updated every 3 months, at least with a literature review. You can see that up there. Last version updated and so on and so on. And therefore, if there's now ongoing constructive and very positive discussion between all these very important people in ICC as well as in WHO. I'm quite sure we will find even better solutions than this or this right now, and that can be implemented in an online tool, because it is stupid to think that we should print a book that still is true for the next 8 years. We are in a very great situation that things are changing so quick that any book is outdated when it is published. This is not if you want to read a novel from Hemingway. This is still great, but this is not for medicine. We are here in medicine, and we have to take care for patients' best diagnosis and treatment, and therefore we have to be updated. And therefore, I'm quite positive that all these scientists, including myself, will find the best solutions for why they are there, why they are paid, not for themselves, not for la pour la, not because they are right if they are wrong, but for saving and patients' life and serving patients' needs. And if everyone believes like that, we are quite on the good way.
Yeah, and I also think that it's really important what you said, to highlight what science is. Science is not everyone is in agreement with each other and says, yeah, you're right, that's correct. That's quite the opposite. And that's
absolutely
why controversy is so good. That's
absolutely
so important.
Yes.
Maybe at the end, when you look back, maybe even to your training, med school, then becoming a physician, being a resident, and then starting on your track, is when you look back. I know some don't like this question because then they feel, oh, am I that old? Do I need to look back that much? But when you look back into your training, what would you give young people at the moment with your experience? What kind of advice would you give? And what, for instance, would you have, what would you wish you would have had at your in your time? What people maybe now have, because that's always my struggle, is many people complain, and I sometimes think, well, it's not that bad. Come on, stop complaining and just move on. What would be your advice with your experience to young physicians now, who maybe struggle with who they want to be, what they want to be, where they want to work?
Yes. Many good questions, some answers. First of all, everyone who is younger than I am, and these are many, many people, all you, that's such a great time we are living in. We go from paper to digital. We go from phenotype to genotype. We go from no drug or some drug to precision medicine drug, to specific target drugs. We go from the smear of a bone marrow to a genome. The turnaround time in our lab for a genome is 7 days, including writing the report. It was impossible 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. It wasn't there. So everyone who is right now younger than I am, you are so lucky where you are, first of all. Second, if I would be younger, I have to regret that I wasn't in the US for some years, or in any other country, but outside Germany. I was in a very small university hospital. It was, as I said before, in 1984. I started to to become a doctor in internal medicine. I was ready with my hematology in 1993. At that time, it wasn't so usual to go for some two or three years. And even if today everyone wants to be at home and it's so nice and work-life balance, go somewhere else, at least for 1 or 2 years. The third thing is, you said that before, no one of us will bioinformatic we started medicine for good reasons. If we wouldn't like to do that, we go for bioinformatic or learn any other thing, economy, something like that. But you have to do this and be absolutely open for any kind of AI or digital tool. And what we are discussing right now, very often, I'm one of the chairs of the task force for AI at the Edge. And what we discussed there, we just submitted a paper also to one journal. How do I read a paper that includes AI? Because is it better then? What are the tools they used? Are these tools feasible for the question and therefore gives us the correct answers? Right now, you can say, well, this PCR was okay, or they know how to do this or that because I know what they're doing. But no one of us knows what are the AI tools. You can just choose, publish a great paper, but it was all stupid because the tool was wrong. And Steve Jobs said, stay hungry and stay foolish. Maybe this is really true also for anyone who's young now. Don't complain, just said, I can complain. Sure, I can complain every day, I do. But think about the solution. Go for the solution and don't stop by complaining about what is wrong. Even if your habit, even if you're stuck in your background, personal, private, as well as at work background, there is no excuse to stay where you are if it's not good. You are free. As when we speak here, we are in such a great situation comparing to many, many other countries in these days all over the world that we are free here. And there are some concerns, there are some problems, there are some things that are difficult to solve. But on the other hand, there are so many options. You just need to do them.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful end to that finale. Thank you very much for your precious time and for your very, very brilliant insights and for your time. I really thank you, and I hope we keep in touch. And I wish you all the best for your work. And I'm sure I will read a lot of about you and your work. And I'm really, really admiring everything that you do, because interestingly, I heard from someone abroad about your lab when I was a med student, and who told me, well, you're in Germany. Don't you know this MML lab? I think, well, okay, let me look it up. And it's a really, really great thing you do. And thank you very much.
Nico, thank you very much. It was really also fun for me. I think you see that. Let me say one very important thing that I did not touch in detail, although you may feel what I how often I thought about that. It's not possible without a team. I said that at the beginning when I say you have to combine experts. I say that you have to know people who do bioinformatics, who do molecular genetics, who do set up the infrastructure and so on. I am just one person. I know very, very few things that I really can do good. This is what is my expertise. But the team is the only thing that can do this. And I just learned that yesterday, we are now above 300 employees in the Munich Leukemia Laboratory. 304 is the number from today. So without all these 303 people plus me, it would not work. And therefore, it's a team effort and it's a team success. And if you think about that, it's great. We have all these people on board working on the why and not only on the how or on the what.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think everyone, when you're very young, you try to, I think this is one of the most challenging things, because we all, yeah, sure, you always think I cannot do this alone, but I also think that's not very, very easy to, as you said from the beginning, to find, first of all, to find people and then to integrate them into one team, especially now with kind of everyone wants to be in the light and everything. But yeah, you just need to be patient and find people you can work with best. And I think that's what you did perfectly.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
MLL is always open. If you want to come here, Nico or the others, feel free.